Welcome, everyone, to The Deep Dive. Today, we're taking a comprehensive journey into the pages of The Washington Post for Saturday, August 9th, 2025. I'm Lee Graham.
And I'm Sam Hurst.
You know, you've sent us a substantial stack of sources, articles, research, your own notes, and our mission, as always, is to extract the most important nuggets of knowledge and insight for you. We're here to give you a real shortcut to being well-informed, packed with surprising facts, and just enough humor, hopefully, to keep you truly hooked.
Exactly. Think of us as your expert guides. We're here to help you understand not just what is in these materials, but crucially, why it matters. We'll connect the dots and explore the broader implications of each piece, giving you that aha moment without the information overload.
And what a day it is in the news. We're diving into high-stakes global diplomacy, the complexities of executive power, critical domestic issues, and some truly compelling human interest and sports stories. It's a packed edition of The Post, and we're going to dive deep into every significant article and topic to give you the full picture. Let's get right to it. We begin with a piece of global diplomacy that could genuinely redefine the geopolitical landscape. President Donald Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin are set to meet next week on August 15th in Alaska. This summit aims to forge a peace agreement to end the war in Ukraine, which Russia invaded 3.5 years ago. What's immediately striking here is the sheer audacity of this proposed framework, especially considering the terms might push Ukraine into significant territorial concessions, possibly without their president Volodymyr Zelensky even at the table.
Indeed, this signals a potential fundamental reordering of international norms. European leaders are already expressing deep distress at the prospect of Trump and Putin imposing terms on Ukraine. It really begs the question, how durable can any peace deal truly be if the primary party affected, Ukraine, isn't fully involved or doesn't agree to the terms? Zelensky has been unequivocal, stating Ukrainians would not gift their land to the occupier and that any peace deals reached without Ukraine are stillborn and simply unworkable.
That's a stark rejection from Kyiv. The very notion of swapping of territories, a phrase Trump has used, suggesting it would be to the betterment of both, is a historical minefield and a very tough sell for Ukraine. The choice of Alaska as a meeting place feels symbolic too, in neutral U.S. territory, but also geographically significant, bordering Russia.
Absolutely. The Kremlin's perspective is telling. Their official, Yuri Ushakov, confirmed the Alaska summit and even hinted at a potential second summit on Russian territory, which speaks volumes about Russia's perceived leverage and confidence. Analysts suggest Putin genuinely believes he's winning the war and aims to fully subjugate Ukraine, strip its military capabilities, and permanently block its NATO membership. This proposed framework aligns perfectly with those long-standing objectives.
The rapid acceleration of this summit is also noteworthy. Just this week, Trump's envoy, Steve Witkoff, had a three-hour meeting with Putin in Moscow. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said Witkoff returned with a proposal that, for the first time, provided concrete examples of the kinds of things that Russia would ask for in order to end the war. This underscores Witkoff's pivotal role as a direct intermediary.
It truly does. This direct channel also highlights the deep frustration among Ukrainian officials who had reportedly hoped the U.S. would insist on a three-way meeting with Zelensky. A senior European official candidly noted, Trump has not put a single iota of pressure on Putin yet. Zero. Zip. This perceived lack of pressure significantly diminishes Europe's diplomatic leverage and raises profound concerns about the global implications for international law and national sovereignty if such a deal is imposed. It sets a dangerous precedent for territorial integrity worldwide.
Moving from high-stakes global diplomacy to a different kind of national security issue, the Trump administration is actively evaluating plans for using military force against Mexican drug cartels. This could range from naval and drone strikes to closer collaboration with Mexican authorities, though they're not considering U.S. boots on the ground. Now, here's what truly stands out. The administration is contemplating military force, but fentanyl seizures in the U.S. have actually been falling since before Trump took office, with recent data showing a 50% decrease from last year. So what's the real story behind this policy push?
This brings up a crucial point about the stated rationale versus the observed reality. Is this a genuine shift in national security policy aimed at curbing drug flow, or is it primarily a political statement? The fact that seizures are down, potentially due to factors like a Sinaloa cartel civil war, China's crackdown on precursor chemicals, or even a decline in fentanyl use itself, seems to contradict the urgency the administration projects. As one former U.S. intelligence official suggested, it's largely messaging and telegraphing, designed to signal a tough stance on a key domestic issue.
It certainly feels like strong messaging. The sheer audacity of even considering military strikes, potentially with Navy destroyers firing missiles, is quite striking. Earlier this year, Trump designated 8 cartels as foreign terrorist organizations and signed an executive order declaring a national emergency regarding them. Secretary of State Marco Rubio advocates treating them as armed terrorist organizations, which expands the tools available to a wider range of U.S. security and intelligence agencies, including the Pentagon, FBI, CIA, and even key intelligence bodies like the National Counterterrorism Center and the National Security Agency.
And those expanded tools are already in use. The administration has significantly increased surveillance drone flights over Mexico and the U.S. southern border, deployed Navy warships for patrols, and diverted CIA resources to counter-narcotics, expanding the Predator drone program over Mexican territory. While no lethal strikes have been authorized for these drones yet, the capability is there. This raises significant legal and ethical questions surrounding unilateral military action within a sovereign country. Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum has already voiced strong opposition, stating any unilateral U.S. military action has nothing to do with Mexican territory and would be a violation of sovereignty.
Right. And the reaction from Congress has been cautious, to say the least. While Republicans haven't immediately reacted, Senator Tim Kaine, a Democrat from Virginia, expressed strong caution, calling any secret directive for military action without consulting Congress short-sighted and lawless. Oh, he warned it would destroy critical bilateral relationships. This whole situation is a complex mix of domestic political signaling, genuine security concerns, and international diplomatic challenges all wrapped up in a high-stakes policy debate. Shifting gears to the domestic front, we're witnessing some truly unprecedented legal battles that directly challenge executive authority and the independence of legal investigations. Let's start with the Justice Department, under Attorney General Pam Bondi, intensifying its legal battle against New York Attorney General Letitia James. The DOJ has issued at least 2 subpoenas to James, one targeting her civil fraud case against Trump's real estate empire, where a judge ordered over $450 million in fines, and another related to her litigation against the National Rifle Association. So what does this aggressive move tell us about the separation of powers in this administration?
What's truly notable here is the intertwining of overt political rhetoric and direct legal action. This sets a concerning precedent for future administrations. The DOJ appears to be investigating whether James violated federal civil rights laws by allegedly conspiring to violate Trump's rights in that fraud lawsuit. Trump has consistently characterized James as a political enemy, frequently decrying the weaponization of law enforcement. This marks the first known instance of the DOJ pursuing potential criminal charges against an official who brought litigation against Trump, making it a very significant development indeed.
James's spokesman, Jeff Bergen, stated they stand strongly behind our successful litigation and called any weaponization of the justice system disturbing. Her attorney, Abby Lowell, went even further, calling it the most blatant and desperate example of this administration carrying out the president's political retribution campaign. It's clear they view this as a politically motivated attack rather than a legitimate legal inquiry.
The procedural details also offer considerable insight. While these investigations don't guarantee indictment, their mere existence can be politically damaging. Attorney General Bondi appointed Ed Martin as special prosecutor in a separate mortgage fraud investigation of James and of Senator Adam Schiff. Martin, a former interim U.S. attorney and a strong Trump loyalist, had previously led a Justice Department task force investigating the weaponization of federal law enforcement. His appointment here is particularly contentious, given his past public statements and clear political leanings.
And it gets even more intricate. John Sarcone, another Trump loyalist, is leading the latest investigations into James. Federal judges had actually declined to extend Sarcone's tenure as U.S. attorney, but Bondi reappointed him as a special attorney to the attorney general, a legally untested move. The Justice Department argues this grants him the full authority of a U.S. attorney. This really shows the lengths to which the administration is willing to go to ensure their favored prosecutors are in place to pursue these investigations. It's a complex and deeply intertwined web of legal and political maneuvering, testing the very boundaries of the justice system.
This battle over executive authority extends beyond Attorney General James. We also saw a federal appeals court panel issue a striking rebuke to a veteran judge, Chief U.S. District Judge James E. Boasberg. They vacated his finding that probable cause existed for contempt proceedings against Trump administration officials in an immigration case. Boasberg had repeatedly clashed with the administration, asserting they showed willful disregard for his authority by proceeding with migrant flights despite his direct orders.
This ruling certainly feels like a strong affirmation of executive power. So, what are the potential long-term risks in your view? of this kind of judicial deference to the executive, particularly concerning immigration policy.
Well, Judges Gregory G. Katsas and Naomi Rao, both appointed by the current administration, wrote concurring opinions, with Rao stating Boasberg exceeded the court's authority and was intruding on the executive branch's powers. This really spotlights the ongoing tension between the executive and judicial branches, reflecting a larger pattern of challenges to judicial authority.
Mm-hmm.
Judge Cornelia T.L. Pillard, an Obama appointee, sharply dissented, arguing the panel lacked appellate jurisdiction, meaning the appeals court shouldn't have even heard the case at that stage. And praising Boasberg for defending court integrity, she emphasized that judges must determine who is responsible when their orders are disobeyed.
And there's another layer, right?
Exactly. To add another layer, a former Justice Department lawyer, Erez Rouveni, blew the whistle, accusing officials of planning to defy court orders, saying, "The planes need to take off no matter what." This puts an even finer point on the direct challenge to judicial authority and its implications for the rule of law. Attorney General Pam Bondi, naturally, celebrated the ruling, calling Boasberg's actions failed judicial overreach at its worst.
And there's another fascinating twist in these legal battles related to Trump's birthright citizenship order. Just weeks after a Supreme Court ruling that seemed to favor the administration by encouraging judges to scale back nationwide injunctions, four lower courts have actually maintained or imposed new nationwide bans on Trump's executive order, which aims to deny automatic citizenship to U.S.-born children of undocumented immigrants and foreign visitors. Now, this seems counterintuitive. The Supreme Court tried to limit these injunctions, and yet we're seeing more of them here. What's going on?
This reveals how the legal system adapts and finds new pathways. The courts are effectively maintaining the status quo and pushing back against policies they deem unconstitutional, even after a Supreme Court procedural ruling. The Supreme Court in Trump v. TESA ruled in favor of the administration on the process of nationwide injunctions. But crucially, it did not rule on the constitutionality of Trump's order itself. They also left open the ability for plaintiffs to try to block a federal policy nationwide through class action lawsuits, which is precisely what we're seeing.
Ah, okay. And that's exactly the strategy judges like Deborah L. Boardman in Maryland have used. She, along with judges in Massachusetts and Seattle, maintained their existing blocks, and a New Hampshire judge even expanded his narrower injunction nationwide after certifying a class action lawsuit. The judges are finding plaintiffs highly likely to succeed on claims that Trump's order is unconstitutional and that the class would be irreparably harmed. States are also arguing they would face significant financial and administrative burdens if these injunctions were narrowed to apply only to specific individuals.
This really highlights the ongoing dilemma for the courts. While conservative legal scholars like John Yoo suggest lower courts are close to defying the Supreme Court by not narrowing their injunctions, he also noted that delaying a final resolution on the order's constitutionality actually serves those opposed to the order. This underscores the broader debate over judicial activism versus upholding constitutional principles and the significant implications for Trump's policy agenda and the power of the federal judiciary. It's a clear demonstration of lower courts utilizing available legal mechanisms to push back on executive actions they believe overstep constitutional bounds.
Moving from these complex legal battles to economic policy and administration personnel, we've seen some remarkably rapid shifts. President Trump replaced IRS Commissioner Billy Long after just 2 months on the job, nominating him as ambassador to Iceland. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent will now serve as acting head. This feels like a revolving door at a critical agency. What does this frequent turnover mean for the stability and functionality of the IRS, especially with tax season approaching?
This rapid turnover and the stated reasons for it point to a strong executive desire for alignment with a specific political agenda, even if it disrupts established processes and traditional norms. Long had reportedly frustrated Treasury by planning to start tax filing season a month late in February and by preemptively announcing the elimination of the direct file program, a decision Treasury had not yet made. This is the fifth person to lead the IRS since Trump's second term began in January, a clear departure from tradition where a commissioner typically serves a full 5-year term to ensure stability and independence.
The criticism from Congress has been quite sharp. Senator Ron Wyden and Representative Richard E. Neal, both top Democrats on committees overseeing the IRS, directly blamed Trump for the agency's turmoil, accusing him of gutting taxpayer service and weaponizing IRS data. They believe this consistent turnover is setting up a disaster for the upcoming filing season, impacting millions of taxpayers.
And this isn't an isolated incident. It's part of a broader pattern. Trump has been actively pushing to overhaul agencies regulating money and finance, including the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and the Federal Reserve. He's even openly mused about firing Fed Chair Jerome H. Powell. He recently signed an executive order to punish banks for debanking, which is essentially financial institutions denying services to customers, often due to perceived political or social risks, and is considering taking Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac out of government control.
Right. Fannie and Freddie. Huge players.
Exactly. For those unfamiliar, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are massive government-backed companies that guarantee about half of all U.S. home loans, playing a critical role in the housing market. This rapid politicization of key financial regulatory agencies raises concerns about their independence and the stability of their critical functions, not just for taxpayers, but for the entire financial system.
Speaking of influential figures within the administration, we need to talk about Bill Poult, the head of the Federal Housing Finance Agency, or FHFA. This relatively little-known agency head, just 37 years old and in the job for 5 months, has remarkably gained Trump's ear on housing and much more. What's truly striking here is the unique way influence is being wielded from this seemingly obscure corner of government.
This really spotlights governance in the digital age and the personalization of policymaking. It reflects a broader trend of leveraging direct communication channels to bypass traditional bureaucratic processes. Poult has quickly ramped up political infighting, accused Senator Adam Schiff and Attorney General Letitia James of mortgage fraud accusations that actually prompted DOJ probes, and has been a leading voice calling for the ousting of Fed Chair Powell. His policy by tweet style, for instance, announcing that Fannie and Freddie were poised to count cryptocurrencies as assets for mortgage loan risk assessments without detailed explanation, has genuinely surprised mortgage bankers, lobbying groups, and even his own staff.
It sounds like it's creating a very confusing environment for the industry he's meant to regulate. Poult has also dramatically overhauled the boards of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, fired top staff, and made himself chairman of both companies. He even added Christopher Stanley from Elon Musk's U.S. DOGE service, a less-known venture tied to cryptocurrency, and Omid Malik, Donald Trump Jr.'s business partner, to Fannie Mae's board. What's particularly concerning is that his agency's announcements almost exclusively come from his personal social media, not the official FHFA website. This lack of clear, formal communication creates significant uncertainty, especially for the future of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which are pillars of the U.S. housing finance system.
Senator Elizabeth Warren urged Poult to focus on his actual job of lowering housing costs, rather than trying to engineer Powell's firing or taking credit for work started previously. This situation vividly illustrates the implications of political appointees making significant policy changes with little notice, and the broader concern about politicizing agencies crucial to the stability of the U.S. housing finance system. It's a clear example of how influence can be wielded through personal connection and direct, informal communication channels, often circumventing established protocols.
Speaking of influence, our next topic delves into how America's top CEOs are approaching the White House, bearing lavish gifts, offering public flattery, and making hefty domestic investments. We're talking about tech leaders like Apple's Tim Cook, NVIDIA's Jensen Huang, OpenAI's Sam Altman, Oracle's Larry Ellison, and SoftBank's Masayoshi Son, who have actively forged alliances with President Trump. What really stands out here is the seemingly clear quid pro quo. Flattery and investment in exchange for policy favors and avoided scrutiny. So what does this mean for fair competition and the regulatory landscape?
This situation reveals the overt nature of influence peddling, moving beyond traditional lobbying to direct personal relationships and public spectacles. It raises a crucial question about transparency and accountability when such high-value businesses are involved. Consider Apple. Tim Cook gifted a 24-karat gold-based plaque to the administration, and Apple subsequently received an exemption from 100% tariffs on semiconductors for building in the U.S. Similarly, NVIDIA's Jensen Huang, after frequent visits to Mar-a-Lago and public praise for Trump, saw his company gain permission to sell advanced H20 chips to China, despite significant national security concerns.
Right. And it wasn't just about direct policy favors. Executives have largely averted new law enforcement investigations, and Trump even reprieved TikTok from a ban that was mandated by a bipartisan law. These outcomes seem to confirm that these personal relationships lead to tangible benefits for the companies involved, directly impacting their bottom line and regulatory environment.
The White House spokesman, Davis Ingle, stated that the administration has a good working relationship with industry leaders to make America wealthy again, guided only by the best interests of the American people. However, the examples provided clearly show specific exemptions and policy decisions that directly benefit these companies after public displays of support and substantial investments. This dynamic raises serious questions about the fairness of the regulatory environment and the potential for national security concerns to be overridden by economic or political considerations when top industry leaders are seen to be currying favor directly with the president. It paints a picture where personal access and strategic displays of loyalty hold immense sway.
This brings us to another significant economic ripple effect. New tariffs are likely to make everyday goods, from cars to clothes and even coffee, more expensive for you, the consumer. The latest round of Trump administration tariffs took effect this week, pushing the average U.S. tariff rate to its highest level since the Great Depression. What really strikes you here is the direct, measurable impact on household budgets. So what does this truly mean for the administration's promised golden age of manufacturing?
This reveals a direct and measurable impact on household budgets and business operations, often in stark contrast with the stated goals of the policy. It raises a crucial question about the effectiveness of tariffs as a tool for economic revitalization. Economists estimate these tariffs will cost U.S. households an average of $2,400 per year. We're talking about substantial markups on everyday items. A 37% jump in clothing costs, 39% for leather shoes and bags, over 3% for food, and a staggering 12% increase for cars, potentially adding about $6,000 to the price of an average new vehicle.
Wow. And it's not just consumers feeling the pinch. Businesses who initially absorbed costs or relied on stockpiles are now depleting those reserves and are compelled to raise prices. Major retailers like Walmart, Nike, and Procter & Gamble are announcing price hikes. The toy industry, for instance, which imports over 75% of its products from China, has already seen prices rise 3.2% since April. Trump's rationale is that these higher tariffs are necessary to combat unfair trade practices, promote domestic manufacturing, and usher in a golden age.
Yet economists like Justin Wolfers from the University of Michigan expect higher prices as these tariffs become permanent. Robert Blecker of American University plainly stated consumers are going to pay, starting with their morning coffee, and Shibnam Kalemli-Eskin from Brown University called it foolish to think there isn't going to be any economic impact.
Right.
The core challenge for businesses is that moving manufacturing out of China is often unrealistic due to cheaper labor and well-established infrastructure and expertise. Companies like Gear Motions in upstate New York are already seeing international inquiries drop by 50% due to trade uncertainty, directly undermining the stated goal of promoting domestic manufacturing. This creates a significant tension between stimulating local production and the immediate, tangible cost to consumers and international trade.
Finally, in this section, we have an interesting diplomatic shift. Vice President J.D. Vance, who has been known for sharp criticisms of the UK, for instance, calling it an Islamist country and dismissing its military history, displayed a notably bridge-building side during his recent visit with British Foreign Secretary David Lammy. What's intriguing here is the adaptability of political personas. The VP, known for his sharp criticisms, is now playing bridge builder. Is this a new Vance or a calculated strategic shift?
This really highlights the adaptability of political personas. It suggests that even the most hardline positions can be softened for diplomatic purposes, especially when personal relationships are cultivated. Vance and Lammy have apparently forged a genuine friendship, despite their political differences, bonding over shared convictions about global tensions, their devout faith. Vance is a converted Catholic, and Lammy as an Anglo-Catholic, and surprisingly, their difficult childhoods.
It's quite a contrast to his previous behavior. Just in February, Vance had a tense exchange with UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer, specifically criticizing Britain's online content regulations as censorship. On this visit, he softened his stance, broadening the issue to a shared Western challenge, not just a British one.
This personal connection seems to be the key factor at play. Lemmy himself described their shared backgrounds, saying there was a great sense that JD completely relates to me, and he completely relates to Angela, referring to Britain's deputy prime minister. This softer diplomatic approach, clearly fueled by personal rapport, could have significant implications for U.S.-UK relations, demonstrating how individual relationships can potentially smooth over broader political disagreements. It will be interesting to see if this bridge-building approach becomes a more consistent feature of Vance's diplomatic engagements, or if it was simply tailored for this specific important visit.
Okay, moving on to global challenges that impact everyday lives in a very visceral way, we have a poignant story from Fiji. Faced with relentlessly rising seas and often insufficient aid, Fijian villages are being forced to literally move uphill. The villagers of Muani, for example, are now deciding whether to relocate on their own or wait for government help, as sea levels there have risen over 11 inches since 1990, a rate triple the global average. This is a very real, very present climate crisis.
Fiji's experience truly serves as a laboratory for climate-driven relocation, a difficult but proactive role. They were among the first countries to move an entire community in 2014 and have since developed a detailed 135-page standard operating procedure for relocation, which could offer valuable lessons globally. However, this raises a critical question about global responsibility and the impact of geopolitical shifts on climate aid. The U.S. State Department spokesperson reaffirmed commitment to the Pacific under the America Safer, Stronger, More Prosperous agenda, but provided no explicit funding for relocation. Currently, New Zealand is the only nation contributing to Fiji's modest $3.5 million trust fund, which is barely enough to move just one village.
Yeah, and this significant funding gap creates a powerful geopolitical vacuum. China recently hosted a summit for 11 Pacific Island countries, pledging climate cooperation and 100 small and beautiful climate projects. This could potentially fill the U.S. funding void, indicating a very real shift in influence in this strategically vital region.
It absolutely does. The human impact is immense and profoundly cultural. Villagers are tired of delays, with some opting to move without government help, pooling their own resources like Mulani, which is using money from pine harvesting. Individuals like Silosi Ramatu, whose grandfather was born 10 yards out to sea from where his house once stood, highlight the deeply painful decisions involved in abandoning ancestral lands. Others, like the Nabavatu villagers, are still living in tents 4 years after a cyclone forced them from their homes. This underscores the urgent reality for Pacific Island nations and the stark inadequacy of current international funding for such massive, culturally sensitive, and necessary relocations.
Another major global challenge dominating the headlines is the Middle East conflict. Israel has approved a plan to escalate the war in Gaza and occupy Gaza City, a significant tactical shift as it would be the first time the Israeli military has been asked to hold and maintain control of the city. This phased takeover could lead to even more deaths of Palestinian civilians and Israeli hostages. What's particularly significant here is Germany's reaction, given their historically staunch support for Israel. So what does this mean for the conflict's trajectory and international relations?
What stands out here is the palpable tension between unwavering support for Israel and mounting humanitarian concerns. Germany, traditionally Israel's staunchest backer in Europe and its largest weapons supplier after the U.S., announced it would halt new weapons exports to Israel that could be used in the Gaza Strip until further notice. This sends a powerful signal and reveals cracks in a previously solid alliance. It prompts us to consider the effectiveness of diplomatic pressure when block-wide action, such as from the European Union, is stalled.
And the international reaction has been swift, with Australia and the UK condemning the plan. Domestically, Netanyahu secured cabinet approval for this move, reportedly avoiding resignations from far-right members of his government and the military chief of staff. His stated aims are to disarm Hamas, return 50 hostages, at least 20 of whom are believed to still be alive, establish Israeli security control, and set up an alternative civilian administration for Gaza.
Domestically in Israel, there have been mass street protests condemning the plan, with many advocating for an immediate ceasefire and the return of hostages. Israeli opposition leader Yair Lapid criticized it as bogging down Israel without a goal. Hamas, for its part, stated that the expansion would cost Israel dearly and holds the U.S. administration responsible. The humanitarian crisis is truly devastating. Most of Gaza's 2 million residents are now displaced into makeshift tent cities, with over 61,000 people killed since the war began, predominantly women and children, and rising deaths from malnutrition and starvation. The anguish of hostage families is, of course, palpable and constant.
From the European Union's perspective, they've threatened action against Israel since May, launching a review that found human rights breaches, but they've largely refrained from block-wide penalties. Germany's decision, while significant, is limited to new exports that could be used in Gaza, rather than a complete halt or broader sanctions.
That's a crucial distinction. The EU acknowledges that conditions for increased aid have not been met and that Israel is denying humanitarian officials access. Yet, they struggle for unified action, partly due to holdouts like Germany and Italy, and partly due to some European allies' understandable wariness of diverging from the U.S. or drawing the Trump administration's ire. As Natalie Tocci, International Affairs Director, noted, the EU proposal is banal, but could become meaningful if it pushes towards serious trade measures. German Chancellor Friedrich Merz, while reiterating Israel's right to defend itself, also stressed that the reoccupation plan makes hostage release and ceasefire negotiations increasingly difficult, and highlighted Israel's clear obligations to provide humanitarian aid. This conflict is truly testing the limits of international alliances and humanitarian responsibility on a global scale.
We also see frustration mounting as Japan questions critical details of its new trade deal with the U.S. Japanese lawmakers are pushing hard for clarity due to differing interpretations of a key component of the agreement. What's truly unusual here is the unique dynamic of this diplomatic relationship. Japan, a key ally, finds itself deeply frustrated by a vague trade deal, and their prime minister openly says Trump is not a normal person.
This really prompts us to consider the reliability of international agreements and the impact of personalized diplomacy versus formalized policy. It underscores the challenges of navigating trade with an administration that explicitly prioritizes its own rules. Japan wants its auto tariffs at 15% as originally agreed, but the U.S. imposed 27.5% and has provided no timeline for the lower rate. Another major point of contention is the $550 billion investment plan Japan pledged to start. Trump claims the U.S. is free to use it as Washington deems fit, which is fundamentally different from Japan's understanding of the deal.
Prime Minister Shigeru Ishiba, as you mentioned, openly defended the vague deal by saying dealings with Trump were not normal and that he doesn't play by the rules. Japan's chief trade negotiator, Ryusei Akazawa, has even resorted to what's described as emergency trips to Washington and diplomatic flattery, using affectionate nicknames like Ratto-chan for U.S. secretaries.
This approach highlights the delicate diplomatic tightrope Japan is walking. Ryo Sahashi, a professor at the University of Tokyo, called the agreements incredible, untrustworthy, and cited the fragility of agreements with the Trump administration. Experts foresee more trouble ahead due to these significant gaps in understanding, with some Japanese officials even expressing a quiet hope that Trump will leave the scene and everything will be forgotten. The economic consequences for key Japanese industries, particularly auto manufacturing, and the long-term implications for the crucial U.S.-Japan security and economic alliance are profound. This serves as a stark example of how personal perceptions and informal communication can destabilize formalized international agreements.
Turning to another critical situation in the Americas, the U.S. has significantly raised the reward for information, leading to the arrest of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro to $50 million. Attorney General Pam Bondi explicitly called him one of the largest narco traffickers in the world. $50 million is a serious bounty. What does this escalating pressure truly mean for U.S.-Venezuela relations and the broader fight against drug trafficking?
What's notable here is the continued escalation of pressure on Maduro, despite previous bounties not leading to his arrest. This leads us to question the actual effectiveness of such measures in achieving regime change or justice. The previous Trump administration indicted Maduro in 2020 on narco-terrorism charges, initially offering a $15 million bounty, later raised to $25 million. The U.S. has not recognized Maduro as Venezuela's legitimate president since 2019, citing deeply flawed elections.
Attorney General Bondi has specifically accused Maduro of conspiring with notorious organized crime groups like Tren de Aragua, the Sinaloa Cartel, and the Cartel of the Suns to traffic cocaine. She stated that the U.S. has seized 30 tons of cocaine linked to Maduro and his associates, with nearly 7 tons directly linked to him.
Maduro, predictably, has vehemently denied these connections, calling the suggestion laughable. His foreign minister dismissed it as a distraction from pressing U.S. domestic issues. While such a substantial bounty is unlikely to lead to his arrest in Venezuela without direct military engagement, it severely limits his ability to travel internationally and significantly increases the pressure on his regime. This situation also underscores the devastating economic crisis and mass emigration from Venezuela under Maduro's leadership, with at least 7.7 million Venezuelans having left the country and hundreds of thousands entering the U.S. in recent years. It's a clear reflection of a persistent U.S. foreign policy goal to destabilize and ultimately remove the Maduro regime.
Shifting to how other nations navigate this unpredictable diplomatic landscape, we look at a piece titled How India Can Win Trump's Trade Game. India desperately needs a trade deal with Trump for both economic and strategic reasons, but a rival, Pakistan, actually finalized the deal first, highlighting India's perceived misplay. Trump has already imposed 25% tariffs on India and threatened 50% if India doesn't stop buying Russian oil. This is where it gets really intriguing. India's economic future appears intertwined with Trump's personal feelings. So what does this say about international trade in an era of personalized diplomacy?
What's truly striking here is the explicit linkage between a major trade deal and the personal perceived slights by a political leader. This forces us to consider how nations navigate foreign policy when domestic political narratives and personal relationships carry such immense weight. The holdup for India is clearly more political and personal than economic. Trump is reportedly frustrated by Prime Minister Modi's refusal to publicly acknowledge Trump's role in the India-Pakistan ceasefire and India's continued Russian oil purchases. Pakistan, in contrast, engaged in what's described as brazen diplomatic flattery, including reportedly nominating Trump for a Nobel Peace Prize.
The economic impact for India is substantial. These tariffs threaten export-dependent industries like gems, textiles, apparel, crude oil refining, and pharmaceuticals, potentially shaving 0.3 percentage points off India's GDP growth. This also makes India less attractive as a manufacturing hub compared to competitors like Bangladesh, Pakistan, and Vietnam, who have already secured more favorable trade terms.
Modi faces a significant dilemma. He needs a symbolic win from Trump without alienating his domestic base, where his strongman image leaves little room for perceived deference. Oppositional leader Rahul Gandhi has already seized on this, suggesting Trump said, "Narendra, surrender," and Modi rolled over. Potential solutions for India, as suggested by analysts, include lowering or eliminating its 10% tariff on U.S. pharmaceuticals, increasing purchases of American energy like liquefied natural gas, and committing to new defense acquisitions such as Javelin missiles and Stryker combat vehicles. This illustrates the complex balancing act leaders face when personal dynamics heavily influence international economic and strategic relationships, demonstrating that sometimes diplomacy is less about policy and more about personality.
Moving to domestic policies and social issues, we have a pioneering development in New York City. They've opened ACES Place in Queens, the nation's first publicly funded homeless shelter, specifically dedicated to transgender and gender nonconforming people. It's fully funded by the city at a cost of nearly $66 million over 5 years. This direct action to address a very vulnerable population's specific needs feels like a powerful statement.
This truly highlights localized solutions to broader national issues. It shows how different levels of government can respond to societal challenges, even when federal policy might be moving in an opposite direction. The NYC Department of Social Services Commissioner, Molly Wasow Park, called it a bright spot and meaningful in this moment in time, especially contrasting with the Trump administration and some states attempting to roll back transgender rights.
The need for such a shelter is, sadly, stark. Transgender people disproportionately experience homelessness, with a 30% lifetime experience rate and 8% experiencing it recently, compared to just 1% for cisgender adults.
Yeah.
Many avoid traditional shelters due to fear of mistreatment or being outright denied access. ACES Place offers 150 beds and comprehensive services, including culinary classes, an on-site psychiatrist, job placement assistance, and a dedicated housing specialist, all with the overarching goal of economic empowerment for its residents.
Advocates are rightly celebrating this as a win for safety and nurturing, expressing hope for replication in other cities and states. While ideally, trans-Pacific housing wouldn't be necessary, as one expert noted, we don't live in the ideal setting. This facility provides a crucial safe space and tailored support for a highly vulnerable population, demonstrating a localized commitment to inclusivity and well-being amidst broader political pushback. It's a testament to targeted support meeting a specific urgent need.
Next, we turn to a localized DC issue that has sparked a significant federal response. An attempted carjacking of a Trump staffer in DC prompted President Trump to threaten to federalize the city's police and call in the National Guard. What's intriguing here is the tension between perception and reality. A single incident sparks a federal response, despite local data showing crime declines. It's a direct clash of federal versus local power.
This really spotlights the unique governance structure of Washington, D.C., and how it makes the city vulnerable to federal bigfooting and political maneuvering, irrespective of actual crime trends. Trump claims D.C. crime is out of control, but the data actually shows crime has been declining for 2 years, thanks in part to local laws like Secure D.C. and increased enforcement efforts by the city.
Yet Trump holds specific, significant powers over D.C. During emergencies, he can commandeer the D.C. police, and the D.C. National Guard reports only to the president. He already established the D.C. Safe and Beautiful Task Force in March, which has led to increased federal law enforcement arrests by agencies like the Park Police, cleared encampments, and increased DEA fentanyl seizures.
The newly confirmed U.S. Attorney for D.C., Jeanine Pirro, has also been publicly vocal, attacking the D.C. Council for coddling youth and urging a lowering of the age of criminal responsibility to 14. This highlights the strong federal push to influence local justice policies. Adding to the controversy, the D.C. Police Union president recently alleged a directive from command staff to adjust crime reports to keep statistics down, a very serious accusation that is now under investigation. This alleged manipulation of crime statistics further underscores the politicization of law enforcement and the unique challenges to D.C.'s autonomy under federal oversight.
Another critical domestic issue affecting many families concerns our veterans. the tragic shooting at a bar in Anaconda, Montana, by a veteran struggling with severe mental health issues, tragically highlights a national crisis. Rigid systems failing to respond to warning signs for veterans. This brings to light the systemic failures in providing adequate mental health care to our combat veterans. It's a critical issue with profound human consequences.
This personal narrative powerfully illustrates a pervasive national problem. It compels us to consider our moral obligation to those who served and the deep structural deficiencies that prevent essential care from reaching them. Veterans face immense struggles with mental health and significant barriers to care. Long wait times, overwhelming paperwork, repeatedly canceled appointments, a constant rotation of doctors, and an unfortunate medicate it and move on approach that often fails to address underlying trauma.
The writer of the letter to the editor, a combat veteran's wife, starkly emphasizes the life and death necessity of prompt mental health care, citing past reports of veterans tragically taking their own lives in VA parking lots as a final desperate statement on a broken system.
The call to action is clear. Congress needs to expand access to care outside the VA system for veterans in desperate need. This story underscores the urgent need for systemic reform to ensure that those who have served our country receive the timely and comprehensive mental health support they not only deserve, but critically need, rather than being trapped in a bureaucratic cycle that can have devastating, even fatal results.
Moving on to another critical domestic challenge, North Carolina recovery funds are being held up in what's described as a DHS paperwork game after Hurricane Helene. This is happening despite $115 million in FEMA public assistance grants already being approved. So what does it mean for communities when they're left in limbo after natural disasters, caught in a bureaucratic maze?
This situation reveals the intersection of disaster recovery with budget reform and political control. It raises a crucial point about the very real practical impact of top-down administrative changes on the ground-level needs of affected communities. DHS Secretary Kristi L. Noem instituted a restrictive budget process in mid-June requiring her approval for expenses over $100,000. This has severely crippled FEMA operations, reducing assistance to North Carolina from $40 million a month to a mere $6.5 million, leaving towns literally starved for funds.
This delay has left cash-strapped rural towns suffering immensely, unsure of reimbursement. This uncertainty, in turn, delays essential services like debris removal, critical wastewater repairs, and rebuilding roads and bridges, directly impacting their ability to rebuild and recover. A Yancey County spokesperson explicitly called it a paperwork game where communities are just left waiting.
The political context here is also significant. Trump had previously lambasted FEMA as slow and ineffective, even suggesting its elimination. While the Biden administration had promised 100% coverage for 180 days after Helene, the Trump administration later reduced that to 90% and denied extensions. Now, Secretary Noem's reportedly hectic schedule and frequent travel further contribute to the delays in processing thousands of piled-up requests. This situation directly impacts communities trying to recover from devastating natural disasters, highlighting the real-world consequences of bureaucratic bottlenecks and shifting administrative priorities that leave already vulnerable communities hanging in the balance.
Another critical public safety issue impacting millions of people who fly is the FAA's ambitious goal to hire 9,000 new air traffic controllers. Even with this target, they'll still be short about 3,000 controllers, and it won't fully plug the shortage for years due to incredibly long training times and high failure rates. What really stands out here is the persistent and dangerous gap in a critical safety job, leading to delays and even fatal accidents. So, what does this ultimately mean for air travel in the near future?
This reveals a significant disconnect between ambitious hiring targets and the challenging realities of a demanding training pipeline. It raises a crucial point about systemic issues within crucial public safety infrastructure and the difficulty of quick fixes. The current reliance on overtime leads to exhausted controllers, significant flight slowdowns and delays across the country, and alarming safety risks. We saw this tragically with the January 29 mid-air collision near Reagan National Airport, which killed 67 people and was directly blamed on a single controller filling two roles due to understaffing.
Transportation Secretary Sean P. Duffy stated the hiring plan would make flying safer and bring about a golden age of travel, with increased pay for new recruits, bonuses, and working with independent colleges, as well as hiring experienced military controllers. However, the challenges are formidable. Hundreds fail the rigorous Oklahoma City Academy each year, and even more fail once they get to their actual training facilities. There are even reports of abuse and hostility from instructors contributing to these high failure rates.
Consider the Long Island facility, for example. It has only half the certified controllers needed and a staggering 69% training failure rate for its trainees. This situation underscores the deep systemic challenges in attracting, training, and retaining qualified personnel in such a high-stress, safety-critical field. Despite the ambitious goals and promises of a golden age of travel, the reality of this demanding training pipeline means the shortage will persist for years, with clear, direct implications for both air travel safety and efficiency.
Now for a look at controversies surrounding a public figure. Representative Corey Mills, a Republican from Florida, is accused by Lindsay Langston, the reigning Miss United States, of threatening to share sexually explicit photos and videos of her, and also threatening violence against her future boyfriends. This is quite a serious battery of accusations against a sitting congressman spanning personal conduct and professional integrity.
This really brings up a crucial point about accountability for public figures and the significant impact such controversies have on political discourse. Mills denies the charges, calling them politically motivated. He claims Langston contacted him for tax assistance after their breakup, suggesting a plot against him. He's also accused a former political opponent, Anthony Sabatini, whom Langston sought legal advice from, of weaponizing the legal system.
But this isn't an isolated incident, which makes it even more concerning. Mills has faced a string of past controversies. An alleged assault investigation involving another woman, though charges were later dropped, an eviction attempt by his landlord for owing over $85,000, which was eventually resolved, and renewed accusations of stolen valor. Specifically, two men Mills was credited with saving from 2003 incidents now claim he wasn't actually present, and these concerns have been formally submitted to the Office of Congressional Conduct.
Adding to this, the House Ethics Committee has an ongoing investigation into Mills for potential financial violations, including campaign finance issues and allegedly profiting from federal weapons contracts. His public image as a MAGA Republican and strong Trump supporter contrasts sharply with these numerous allegations. The sheer volume and severity of these claims, coupled with multiple ongoing investigations, really bring into question his overall integrity and suitability as a public figure, creating significant pressure for accountability.
In Texas, the Attorney General Ken Paxton is suing to remove 13 absent Democratic lawmakers from their seats. These lawmakers fled the state to prevent the GOP-controlled legislature from redrawing congressional district maps to create 5 new safe Republican seats. This is gerrymandering taken to a truly dramatic level. So, what does this mean for the future of representative democracy and the balance of power in Texas?
This situation powerfully illustrates high-stakes political brinkmanship and the aggressive use of legal and even law enforcement tools in a legislative battle. It compels us to consider the lengths to which political parties will go to secure power through redistricting. The state house needs 100 of its 150 members for a quorum to conduct business, and the Democrats' absence effectively freezes legislative proceedings. Ordinarily, redistricting occurs every 10 years after a census, making this mid-decade special session highly unusual and overtly contentious.
Trump is a central figure in this conflict, explicitly urging Texas to act, claiming he's entitled to 5 more seats, and calling for other GOP-led states to shift districts. He also plans a census excluding undocumented immigrants, a move widely expected to face immediate litigation.
Paxton's lawsuit is seen by Democrats as legal harassment and a desperate attempt to achieve in the courts what they have failed to do in the court of public opinion. End quote. Republicans have even issued civil arrest warrants for the absent Democrats, and Senator John Cornyn of Texas claimed the FBI agreed to help track them down, though the FBI declined to comment on this. The conflict has escalated further with actual bomb threats at the Democrats' hotel in Illinois, and Governor Abbott threatening to draw even more GOP-friendly maps, potentially 6 to 8 new seats if the Democrats don't return. This extreme example of partisan conflict illustrates the deep divisions and aggressive tactics being employed to secure political power through the manipulation of district maps, pushing the boundaries of legislative and legal precedent.
Switching gears to something that affects almost everyone in this digital age, we have the pervasive issue of data privacy and what happens when apps leak our most sensitive information. Recent incidents include a cyber attack on the T-Dating Advice app, which exposed sensitive personal data of thousands of women, everything from private discussions and reviews of men to photos, and then used that leaked data to create a map of users' locations online. Separately, a California jury just found Meta wrongfully collected data from women using the Flow period tracking app. This really brings home how vulnerable our digital lives have become. So what happens when these apps leak our most sensitive data, and who is truly responsible?
This raises a crucial point about the regulatory landscape and corporate accountability. If we connect this to the bigger picture, The enduring lack of comprehensive U.S. data privacy law leaves a significant gap, effectively allowing rapid innovation without sufficient consumer protection. The Tea app specifically exposed intimate discussions, highly personal reviews and photos, and the subsequent creation of a map showing users' locations from that leaked data led to multiple class action lawsuits, highlighting the severe real-world consequences of such breaches.
And it's not just small startups struggling with security. Instagram just rolled out a new map feature that shares precise, real-time location with friends, combining actively tagged locations with passive, always-on background sharing, meaning where you last opened the app. This raises significant privacy concerns, from exes or professional contacts potentially tracking movements, to social pressure, or even alarming safety risks like harassment, stalking, or intimate partner control, despite Instagram's claims that location data isn't used for ads.
Cybersecurity experts point out that many small startups simply don't know how to store information securely, and the Tea app's setup reportedly lacked basic security precautions and testing. Even more alarming, the emerging trend of vibe coding, where AI tools write software, could make new apps 100 times worse by enabling inexperienced developers to spin up applications without proper safeguards. This poses an outsized risk to women and other vulnerable groups. Crucially, app stores like Apple continue to host these apps despite their own guidelines requiring appropriate security measures, raising serious questions about their responsibility in enforcing security standards and protecting user data. It paints a troubling picture of rapid technological advancement outstripping user protection.
Next, we turn to the financial future of public broadcasting. Federal funding for public radio, specifically NPR and PBS, formally ended last month. This has been a long-held Republican goal, now accomplished by the Trump administration, who labeled them left-wing propaganda. What does this major shift in funding truly mean for public broadcasting and access to information, especially in rural areas?
This really highlights the significant ripple effect of this funding cut. While NPR itself gets only about 1% of its overall budget from federal funds, many of its member stations, especially those in rural areas, are far more dependent, some relying on federal funds for up to 30% or even more of their budget. This stark reality means that 78 of the 246 member stations are now in imminent danger of going dark, a potential outcome that could fundamentally alter the public media landscape across the country. This raises a crucial question about the role of public funding in sustaining diverse and accessible media ecosystems, particularly in underserved communities.
NPR CEO Catherine Marr, who joined in March 2024 from Wikipedia, is offering $8 million in fee relief to the neediest stations and actively negotiating with PBS to take over critical infrastructure, like music rights management and distribution services, previously handled by the now defunded Corporation for Public Broadcasting. She maintains an optimistic outlook, viewing this crisis as an opportunity for stations to work more collaboratively and coordinatedly. She also firmly rejects the partisan bias criticisms, stating that NPR stands for democracy and the Constitution and the role of the press.
Maher does acknowledge there's always work to do in representing cultural conversations across the country, calling the expectation of perfect representation for all 330 million citizens an unrealistic request. This really underscores the double-edged sword of criticism regarding federal funding and the expectation of absolute neutrality. Despite the significant financial challenges, strategies like increased listener donations and local philanthropies are becoming even more crucial as public broadcasting navigates this unprecedented new financial reality, fighting to maintain its reach and impact.
Our next story is about history, and perhaps more accurately, how it's told and presented in public spaces. The Smithsonian's National Museum of American History has restored a placard describing President Trump's 2 impeachments to its American Presidency exhibit after temporarily removing it last month. The updated display now reflects all presidential impeachments. What's truly revealing here is how a public institution like the Smithsonian finds itself caught in the crossfire of competing political narratives about history.
This really prompts us to consider the crucial role of national museums in presenting contentious historical events, especially when they are so recent and politically charged. It reflects a broader societal struggle over whose version of history gets told and how political pressure can influence cultural institutions. The interim sign was initially removed due to inconsistencies with other sections and because it was blocking a display case. However, its removal immediately drew swift outcry from the public and Democratic leaders like Senator Schumer, who publicly called it pathetic.
The White House, through official Lindsey Halligan, who is notably charged with scrutinizing improper ideology at the Smithsonian, reiterated that no government official asked for the content's removal. However, she also explicitly
encouraged steps aligning with Trump's executive order to restore truth to American history, noting his two Senate acquittals. Trump, of course, holds the unique distinction of being the only president to have been impeached twice, first in 2019 for abuse of power and obstruction related to Ukraine, and then again in 2021 for incitement of insurrection after the January 6th Capitol attack. He was acquitted by the Senate both times.
The updated text in the exhibit now includes the word alleged when describing the conduct for the first impeachment, a subtle but significant change in historical framing. Some visitors even commented that the text for Trump felt a little bit smaller than for other presidents. This constant scrutiny and the very public debate over museum content highlight the immense challenges cultural institutions face in maintaining neutrality and factual integrity when dealing with recent and politically divisive historical events. It reflects a larger pattern of attempts by the Trump White House to directly influence Smithsonian exhibits, pushing for a narrative aligned with their interpretation of historical truth.
And now for a few quick hits from D.C., Maryland, and Virginia local news. First, Fairfax County is hiring a bodyguard for its school superintendent, Michelle Reed, due to a troubling rise in threats. This is a clear sign of increasing tension at the local level. What does this mean for school leadership in today's climate?
This situation underscores the escalating pressures and targeted violence now faced by public officials, even at the local level within education. Superintendent Reed initially resisted, but the growing threats and political tensions compelled the school board to approve this measure at a significant cost. It also comes as Fairfax schools face investigations by the Trump administration's education department regarding magnet school admissions and policies for transgender students matching gender identity in facilities, adding layers of complexity to her role.
We also have a deeply impactful human interest story about a local lawsuit. Sandy Spring Friends School sued Bianca Johnson, a single mom, for $27,000 for tuition for her daughter who never even attended the school. After a Washington Post article brought significant attention to the case, the new head of school publicly apologized and vowed to void the debt.
This raises a crucial point about contract law, financial aid transparency, and the potential impact of legal action on vulnerable families. It's a powerful human interest story with broader implications for private institutions' accountability and how they navigate agreements, especially when they can lead to such significant hardship for individuals. Johnson, who experienced evictions as a child, found this particularly devastating. It's also worth noting the school has filed 11 similar cases in Maryland courts over the past decade.
A truly disturbing local story from Northwest DC. Thomas Mary, a 42-year-old Australian national and former diplomat and World Bank consultant, has been arrested and charged with sexually abusing three children in his neighborhood. This case highlights the deeply sensitive and often complex journey of the legal process in such matters.
Indeed. Police actually sought a warrant for Mani back in November 2023, but the U.S. attorney declined at the time, citing the high burden of proof. Now he faces multiple first and second degree child sexual abuse charges. A fourth child has also come forward reporting abuse. Mani is being held without bond due to flight risk, given his past diplomatic ties. It's a chilling case that will undoubtedly have a profound impact on community trust and highlights the complexities of prosecuting such sensitive crimes that involve vulnerable populations.
And for something a little different, this deep dive also uncovered a fascinating local avian mystery solved by a DC biologist. The title alone, Birds Kept Dropping Dead, a DC biologist cracked the case, hints at a truly interesting discovery.
And finally, a unique weather phenomenon. An article describes a violent, localized gust of wind that tore through the Washington Canoe Club in Georgetown, shredding an anchored umbrella, hurling Adirondack chairs into the Potomac, and flipping a canoe. This happened on August 3rd with estimated winds of over 45 miles per hour, but local weather stations only recorded 1421 miles per hour. This prompts us to consider the complexities of microclimates and unpredictable natural events. What's intriguing here is the mystery behind a powerful, isolated gust that completely defied local readings. The cause remains, for now, unknown.
Okay, moving on to the world of sports, we have a truly historic moment in Major League Baseball. Jen Paul will become the first woman to umpire regular season MLB games this weekend, umpiring three games, including a historic assignment behind home plate on Sunday. What's truly significant here isn't just a glass ceiling shattering, but Jen Paul's decade-long journey and what this moment means for representation in professional sports.
This really prompts us to consider the pace of change in traditional institutions like MLB, especially compared to other professional sports. It underscores the systemic barriers women have faced in sports officiating and the sheer power of perseverance. The NBA, for instance, had female referees 30 years ago, the NFL 10 years ago, and FIFA had an all-female crew at the World Cup in 2022. It is, as MLB Commissioner Rob Manfred noted, long overdue and a true reflection of Powell's hard work, dedication, and love of the game.
Powell's journey has been a steady, determined climb since she started at Ted Barrett's clinic in 2015, earning a scholarship to umpiring school, working in the Gulf Coast League in 2016, and reaching the Class AAA Championship in 2023. She's now one of just 17 Class AAA umpires trusted as major league substitutes.
She described the phone call receiving the news as super emotional, feeling super full, like a fully charged battery. She even made a point of texting former minor league umpire Pam Postema, who reached Class AAA in the 1980s but never broke into MLB, saying simply, "I'm getting it done," acknowledging Postema's pioneering efforts. Pale aims to be a good steward and representative for young girls and women and boys and men that this is possible, paving the way for the six other women currently umpiring in the minors. It's a powerful moment of both personal achievement and broader representation.
Now to the NFL preseason, which has already seen some notable injuries and game stoppages, reminding us how quickly a preseason moment can impact a team's entire season outlook. In one instance, Colts quarterback Anthony Richardson, vying for the starting job, suffered a dislocated pinky finger on his throwing hand during a first quarter sack. This is a familiar, painful story for the Colts, who have faced quarterback instability for years.
This truly brings up a crucial point about managing high-potential but injury-prone players and the ripple effects such a critical position's instability has on a franchise. Richardson, the fourth overall pick in 2023, already has a history of injuries, including shoulder surgery in his rookie season and a back injury in 2024, having played only 15 games. This latest injury, while described as day-to-day, immediately brought Daniel Jones, signed to a one-year, $14 million deal, into relief, highlighting the Colts' ongoing quarterback uncertainty since Andrew Luck's retirement. Coach Shane Steichen now faces the immediate challenge of reevaluating his quarterback planning.
In another preseason game, the Lions-Falcons contest was actually halted after Detroit Lions safety. Maurice Norris was seriously injured attempting a tackle, hitting the helmet with his head snapping back. While he was thankfully in stable condition and hospitalized overnight, it was a very scary moment on the field that led to an early end to the game. What's compelling here is the human element that overrides the competition itself.
This really highlights player safety in football, especially during the preseason. It reflects a growing awareness and willingness within the NFL to prioritize player well-being over game completion, spurred by recent high-profile injuries. This decision by coaches Dan Campbell and Raheem Morris to suspend the game, per New York, echoed similar instances in the 2023 preseason and, of course, chillingly recalls DeMar Hamlin's cardiac arrest in January 2023. These moments underscore the seriousness with which the league is now treating player welfare, even at the cost of a full game.
Finally, we have the Washington Commanders' preseason opener, a sloppy, penalty-laden 48-18 loss to the Patriots, where they sat 30 players, including most starters. Despite a rough team loss, there were some individual bright spots. This early glimpse into the team's future talent is what catches your eye.
This brings up an important point about the nuanced purpose of preseason games, balancing player evaluation with injury risk, and how coaches manage expectations around performance given differing approaches to playing starters. First-round pick Josh Connerly Jr. at right tackle and second-round pick Trey Amos at cornerback both showed steady improvement and excellent play. Running back Ja'Cory Kroski-Merritt shined with wicked cuts and elusiveness before leaving with a shoulder injury, which fortunately turned out to be clean. While Coach Dan Quinn expressed frustration over the sloppiness, he also emphasized that he enjoys those moments to find out who can emerge, underscoring the vital player evaluation aspect of these early games, even if the team result is poor.
Sticking with baseball, but from a very different perspective, there's an interesting piece titled, "What It Feels Like to Love One of the Worst Teams in Baseball," referring to the Washington Nationals. The team is in a difficult rebuild, sputtering with a dismal 17-39 record since June, the worst in baseball. The Juan Soto trade in 2022 was described as a punch to the soul, and both the longtime manager and general manager have been fired. What's truly compelling here is the fan experience of sticking with a losing team and the enduring hope and deep loyalty of these Nationals fans despite overwhelming negativity.
This really forces us to consider the psychological contract between sports teams and their fan bases and what it truly takes to maintain engagement during a prolonged rebuild. It's a microcosm of the challenges of managing expectations and delivering on promises in professional sports. Fans are clearly frustrated, chanting "sell the team," refusing to buy new jerseys, and actively considering cutting season ticket plans. Some even want Ted Leonsis, the successful owner of the Wizards, Mystics, and Capitals, to buy the team, citing his rapid turnaround of the NFL team after its ownership change.
But even in this despair, there are glimmers of hope. Pitcher Cade Cavalli, for instance, returned after an astonishing 1,076 days away, pitching 4.1 scoreless innings and showing stuff that can make fans dream. Catcher Riley Adams hit a solo shot, and C.J. Abrams secured a walk-off win against the Athletics. Fans cling to these little things, revealing a deep, almost irrational loyalty that persists.
The fan profiles interviewed range from an 11-year-old meticulously discussing long-term plans for the team to seasoned ticket holders questioning ownership's commitment, all expressing a desire for more analytics and investment in minor leagues. It speaks to the enduring nature of sports fandom, where hope for a distant future is nurtured by small, fleeting moments of success amidst overwhelming losing, underscoring the deep emotional and even spiritual investment fans have in their teams.
Switching gears to something truly symbolic, President Trump recently signed an executive order reviving the presidential fitness test, that classic measure of sit-ups, pull-ups, and a mile run from the 1950s. Golfer Bryson DeChambeau and WWE CCO Triple H were even in attendance at the ceremony. This feels like a return to a classic, but perhaps outdated, measure of fitness. What's particularly striking is the symbolism behind this revival and how it contrasts with more modern approaches to well-being.
This prompts us to consider the effectiveness of top-down fitness mandates versus more holistic wellness approaches. It reflects a generational and ideological divide on what constitutes fitness and how it should be promoted, particularly for youth. Critics view this move as another example of Trump dismantling or dismissing something his Democratic predecessors did, and a clear preoccupation with what he thinks looks tough, aligning with his MAGA movement's imagining of masculinity.
This stands in stark contrast, for example, to former Spelman College president Beverly Tatum, who adopted a comprehensive wellness initiative for the entire student body by cutting intercollegiate athletics in favor of a holistic approach that aligned with Michelle Obama's "Eat Better, Move More, Sleep Well" slogan. It's about overall health, not just competitive performance.
The contrast is quite clear. One approach focuses on a narrow, competitive measure of physical performance rooted in a past era, while the other prioritizes overall well-being and health for a broader population. It highlights the ongoing debate about how best to encourage healthy lifestyles, especially for young people, and the symbolic weight attached to such initiatives by political leaders. It's a question of philosophy as much as policy.
Finally, in the world of sports, we have a compelling story from the golf world. Tommy Fleetwood has found his groove and built a significant lead at the PGA Tour Playoffs opener, the St. Jude Championship. He's currently ranked no 1,001 with 7 wins on the European Tour, but he's famously yet to secure a PGA Tour title. What's particularly compelling here is the high stakes of the PGA Tour Playoffs, where one win can completely change a player's career trajectory and financial future.
Fleetwood is truly giving himself another golden opportunity to finally break through and win on the PGA Tour. And as we saw with Kurt Kitayama's impressive low score for the round, moving him dramatically up the leaderboard, it reminds us how quickly fortunes can change in these FedEx Cup playoffs. Kitayama was barely ranked at over 110 before winning a prior tournament, and now he's at NOAA 52, aiming for the top 50 to assure entry into next year's lucrative $20 million signature events. This illustrates the intense competition and the truly significant financial and career implications for these golfers in the playoffs, where every shot counts.
Moving on to some truly compelling human stories and cultural touchstones from today's post, we note the passing of a true American hero, James A. Lovell Jr., who famously commanded the Apollo 13 mission. He died at 97. His story reminds us of one of the most incredible tales of human ingenuity and resilience in space exploration. What's truly remarkable are the details of how he and his crew navigated that seemingly impossible situation.
This really forces us to consider the nature of courage and problem solving under extreme pressure. Apollo 13 became a testament not just to individual skill, but to collaborative crisis management between the crew and mission control on Earth. The explosion cost the vessel 2 of its 3 fuel cells and all its oxygen, sending the ship thousands of miles off course. Lovell, a highly experienced Navy test pilot, expertly steered the crippled spacecraft using only the Earth visible in the window, with computer systems shut down to conserve power, even though the ship's new center of gravity made piloting incredibly difficult.
The crew endured 4 grueling days of dehydration, sleep deprivation, and near-freezing temperatures. Engineers on the ground famously designed a way to fit a square air filter into a round hole to combat dangerously rising CO2 concentrations inside the capsule. Lovell's expert piloting turned an impossible mission into one that was merely improbable, culminating in a safe splashdown after a chillingly long communication blackout that left the world holding its breath.
While Apollo 13 was a dramatic, successful failure, Lovell himself considered Apollo 8, the first crewed spacecraft to orbit the moon in 1968, to be the true highlight of his career. On that mission, he helped spot the iconic Earthrise photo, a groundbreaking image that changed humanity's perspective of Earth. His life story, from building his first rocket at 16 to his legendary space missions, is a powerful narrative of human resilience, ingenious problem-solving under duress, and the deep collaborative spirit that truly defines grand human endeavors.
From the perils of space to the evolution of artistic expression, we have a piece arguing that it's time for solo shows to move beyond simply relying on the trauma plot. The core idea is that while solo shows often use personal trauma for audience enlightenment, the genre is evolving to be more than just personal, finding deeper social and political currents. What's fascinating here is how artists are finding genuinely new ways to connect intensely personal experiences to universal themes.
This really prompts us to consider the dynamic role of art in processing collective experience and challenging societal norms. The most impactful works are those that successfully leverage individual stories to reflect broader social and political currents, moving beyond mere confession to catalyze empathy and deeper understanding. Pioneers like Richard Pryor, John Leguizamo, and Margaret Cho certainly used confessional comedy for catharsis and education, but new approaches are emerging, toying with form, incorporating elaborate projections, and even musical comedy.
The article highlights compelling examples of this evolution. Ricky Lindholm's Dead Inside is an infertility memoir delivered with plucky tunes and an incisive critique of societal pressure on women to suffer in silence about pregnancy loss, even using a smiley face system for emotional tracking. Another is Morgan Bigucci's Can I Be Frank, a hilarious and poignant tribute to gay comedian Frank Maia, who died of AIDS in 1995. This piece honors past mentors lost to AIDS and poses crucial questions about the inherited world and current nightmares.
These examples demonstrate how personal narratives can be expanded into broader societal critiques, making the art resonate more deeply. Conversely, Josh Sharp's Ta-Da is cited as less effective, centering too much on a singular personal coming-out narrative, which felt to critics like a two-dimensional gimmick. The most compelling works, then, are those that transform individual experience into a vessel for collective understanding, pushing the boundaries of the solo performance genre and moving it beyond simple catharsis.
Next, we have a timeless piece of advice from Carolyn Hacks, titled, Ex-Best Friend is Back After Being Left by Abusive Wife. The reader's dilemma involves a friend whose controlling, isolating, manipulative, and deceitful wife finally left him for a wealthy boss, leaving him with a nasty custody battle. The reader desperately wants to support the friend, but struggles with those strong told-you-so urges. What's truly insightful here is the wisdom in stepping back from those vindictive, I-told-you-so moments and focusing purely on true, unselfish support.
Hacks's advice is a masterclass in compassionate practicality. She advises the reader to see this as a cause for genuine celebration. Getting the friend back, and the friend finally getting his life back, noting that many people never manage to escape control freaks. She even frames the wealthy boss as a gift in this context. And crucially, she suggests that if the friend can even get partial custody, the child will have a chance for a healthier home environment. The core of her advice is to support through consistent, unselfish friendship, not by trashing the ex-wife or trying to force the friend to see this as a new start before he's emotionally ready. It's a truly empathetic and practical approach to navigating complex human relationships and the tempting urge for personal vindication.
And finally, a very public legal battle reaching a surprising conclusion. The Mandalorian actress Gina Carano has settled with Lucasfilm and Walt Disney Co., ending her Elon Musk-funded lawsuit. She'd accused them of firing her from The Mandalorian for posting right-wing views on social media. What's truly intriguing here is the complete turnaround from Lucasfilm's original very strong statement about her.
This really forces us to consider the ever-evolving boundaries of free speech in professional contexts, especially when an individual's public statements appear to conflict with a company's values or brand image. It underscores the growing tension between personal expression and corporate responsibility in the digital age, and the significant influence of figures like Elon Musk in championing certain causes. Lucasfilm initially dropped Carano in 2021 after a social media post where she implied conservatives were treated like Jews in Nazi Germany, calling her posts abhorrent and unacceptable, and stating unequivocally they had no plans to work with her again.
Carano, for her part, claimed she was hunted down online simply because her views were not in line with the acceptable narrative. Her lawsuit was notably funded by Elon Musk as part of his public promise to fund lawsuits for people he believes were unfairly treated by employers over posts on X, formerly Twitter.
While the specific terms of the settlement are undisclosed, Carano expressed being pleased with the outcome and hoping for healing to the force. Most surprisingly, Lucasfilm released a statement saying they now look forward to identifying opportunities to work together with Mrs. Carano in the near future. This complete reversal, after such strong condemnations and a public legal battle, truly highlights the complexities and pressures involved in balancing corporate image, employee rights, and the influence of powerful external figures like Elon Musk in today's public discourse. It shows that in the current landscape, very public conflicts can sometimes lead to unexpected reconciliations. #tag outro.
And that brings us to the end of our incredibly detailed deep dive into the Washington Post for Saturday, August 9th, 2025. From high-stakes political maneuvers and significant economic shifts to deeply personal human stories and the changing landscape of sports, we've covered a vast array of topics, all from that single rich source.
It's been a truly fascinating look at the complexities of our world, highlighting how interconnected, seemingly disparate events truly are. From the geopolitical power plays and the nuanced battles over executive authority to the quiet courage of individuals navigating personal challenges and the shifts in our digital landscape, the nuances really do matter.
As you go about your day, think about this. Many of the stories we explore today, from climate migration in Fiji to the ongoing battles over birthright citizenship, or even the persistent struggle for mental health care for veterans, consistently illustrate a profound tension. It's the tension between global challenges that demand collective action and national or even individual interests that often clash. So what does this all mean for how we as a society balance the immediate needs of the many with the long-term implications for all?
This prompts us to consider. In a world increasingly shaped by both personal influence, as we saw with the CEOs and the Carano settlement, and systemic forces like climate change or legal precedents, where do you see the most impactful changes being made? And perhaps more importantly, where do you think your focus should be directed to truly understand and engage with these complex, evolving issues?
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. I'm Lee Graham.
And I'm Sam Hurst.
We look forward to diving deep with you again soon.